you want to turn to John 4, I know last week we looked at Jesus and personal evangelism from John chapter 4, and we looked at his interactions with the Samaritan woman. And we just want to go back and pick up a little bit of the teaching that he did to the disciples in the midst of that, and then move on to the end of the chapter where he performs another miracle. And we want to talk about the miracles and signs just a little bit. It's amazing. And when we mention the miracles and signs, when we look at the thing that with this woman at the well and how many people are brought to him, there's no indication that he healed anybody or performed any extravagant miracles. Now, certainly we could say that, well, him knowing the details of her life was miraculous. It was miraculous knowledge that he knew about her past husbands and so forth. Yes, but he didn't perform any big miracles to those people, and yet they all believed him just from talking with him. And yet the Jews, who were supposed to be God's people, are constantly not believing in him in spite of the miracles that he does. It's an amazing thing to think about. Here he was. He came to bring God to the people, God in the flesh, trying to show them the very one who created them. And they were around him all of this time, and they couldn't see what they were looking at. We talked about what we're looking at this morning. They were looking right at Jesus, the Son of God, God in the flesh. They're looking right at him, and all they saw was some carpenter from Nazareth. That's all they could see. Some fella who's mother and brothers are still living over there in the next town. You know, that's the kind of thing that we have with them. I want to go back then to John chapter 4, and beginning in verse 31, we want to catch those few verses there from 31 to 38 and look at a little bit of the teaching and how that's relevant to us. We briefly mentioned one of these verses this morning, but we want to touch on it again. In verse 31, this is after he had spoken to the woman and she'd gone back to town, and now the Samaritans were on their way out. But in verse 31, the disciples had finally come back from town. They'd gone into town to get some food. They come back to town and they are begging him to eat something. And we don't sometimes maybe think about just how desperate a situation it was. I don't know how long it had been since he had eaten something, but they seem to think it was pretty urgent that he take some food, get some nourishment. And yet Jesus is not that interested in eating physical food because he's enjoying the spiritual food that he's received. And he says to them, "I have food to eat that you don't know about." And of course, and time and again, this is a problem not only with the disciples, but certainly with the Jews and with others that talk to Jesus. Time and time again, when he says something spiritual, and we hearken back to the time he was talking with Nicodemus in chapter 3, when he speaks of heavenly things, when he speaks of spiritual things, it just goes right over their head because they're not spiritually minded people. And sometimes it's easy for us to look back at that and we read it in the context there, and we say, and then he explains that they're saying, has somebody brought him some food that we don't know about? Now, what are the odds that the Samaritans are going to bring food to a Jew that happens to be wandering through their land? No, there's not much chance that that's actually happened. But they're trying to force some literal meaning into his spiritual statement. They're trying to make it something that they can understand with their carnal minds, their physical nature, instead of understanding his spiritual meaning. And so he has to explain it to them in verse 34. "My food is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work." That's why he's here. That's what he came to do, and that's what sustains him. Do you remember when we talked about Satan's temptation to turn the stones to bread? Jesus' response to him was, "Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God." You see, we think that food is what sustains us. But Jesus said, no, that's not it. You can't live on food alone. You've got to have God in order to sustain your life. And we talked about that a little bit in class a couple weeks back in Dwayne's class. But we want to notice that here he's saying, you know, I've got something that sustains me in a spiritual sense beyond the physical. And we read these few verses and we say, oh, well, why couldn't the disciples see that's what he was talking about? And we're quick to jump on them and, they just didn't understand anything and they couldn't see anything he was talking about. But can we be honest with ourselves for a minute and put ourselves back there in their shoes? Would we have understood what he was talking about until he explained it? Most likely, most of us probably wouldn't have. It'd be the rare individual that really would grasp the things that Jesus was talking about, because he was talking on a different level of comprehension than most people had ever experienced before. It wasn't that he was using complicated words that they didn't understand, but he was kind of speaking in code, and they didn't necessarily understand the code all the time. When he said food, they talked about food. They thought he was talking about food. When he talks about beware of the leaven of the Pharisees in another place, they think he's talking about the bread. It's because we didn't bring any bread that he's talking, warning us about. They're constantly thinking physical thoughts. Isn't that a lot of what wraps our life? Our lives are wrapped up in the physical things. We eat three times a day, some of us more than that, some of us only once a day from the time we get up to the time we go to bed. But we eat, we sleep, we drink, we walk, we talk, we do all these physical things. And so it's easy for us to let the spiritual fly right over the head. And that's what happened to these folks time and time again. And you would think, well, you know, surely after a while they'd figure it out and they'd get that, well, Jesus is probably talking about something spiritual. But sometimes he did talk about physical things. You know, as we think about the feeding of the 5,000 or the feeding of the 4,000, when he said, let's get them something to eat, they could have said, well, you know, you've been teaching them, you've been giving them all this spiritual food. No, but he was actually talking about physical food that time. So that kept them off kilter enough just each time they were wondering, okay, what's he talking about this time? And so we need to be careful about being judgmental toward the disciples and thinking, well, if I'd have been there, I would have done this or that or the other. I would have understood. I would have done this. I would have said that. We would have been in the same boat with them. We would have not understood so much of the things that he was trying to teach us. And in fact, today, we think about how little of the Bible we would understand if it weren't for the fact that it explains itself in various places. We think about some of the parables that Jesus told, and would we understand them if he hadn't explained them to the disciples? We wouldn't have any idea what he's talking about in some of those things. We'd just be taking wild guesses. And that certainly is the case in places where there are some odd prophecies in the Old Testament, and even some of the things in the New Testament that we really struggle with knowing, what is that talking about? It's some troubling things in there in a few places. Peter said that some of the things that Paul wrote were hard to understand. And it's true. Some of that, it's hard to understand. And so we need to be careful about our attitude toward those who have gone before us, and assuming that they should have understood or known what we understand or know. They didn't always have that option. And remember, we read this whole section, but for them it was happening one moment at a time. We can read it and think about the context of other Bible books, other chapters. Other writers had to say things about that was inspired. They didn't have that benefit of, you know, saying, oh, well, what did Peter say about this over in 1 Peter? Or what did Paul say about that in Corinthians? They couldn't do that. They couldn't look to another chapter. So they had to depend on what was going on right then and there. But as we think about them thinking this, then he says to them, and we talked about this briefly this morning, do not say there are yet 4 months and then comes the harvest. Look, I tell you, lift up your eyes and see the fields are white for harvest. And of course, the comparison of converted souls to a harvest is all through the Scriptures. And certainly John uses it here. and he also uses it in Revelation 14 through 19, five references to it in those five verses over there when he talks about it as well. And that, of course, being the harvest of the final time of reaping the souls in, bringing them in to heaven. We even sing those songs about bringing in the sheaves and things. Well, we're not really talking about gathering in the hay. Sorry, Bobby, I know you thought that was all about getting the bales of hay together. No, that's about the souls, isn't it? Well, we sing those songs. We use that imagery. And so John uses it here. He uses it in Revelation. He uses it time and again. But then Jesus says to them, "Already the one who reaps is receiving wages and gathering fruit for eternal life." Do we realize that that's what we're doing when we're out there bringing souls to the Lord? That we are gathering fruit for eternal life. And we talked about the struggles and difficulties and the challenges that we face in talking to people about Jesus and about the gospel sometimes, and the things that we shy away from really getting into discussions with people sometimes. But here is one of the motivations that should motivate us to get out there. We are getting fruit for eternal life when we bring those souls to Christ. And so then he goes on to say, "For here the saying holds true, one sows and another reaps." In 1 Corinthians 3:6, of course, Paul builds on that analogy as well, talking about one planting and another watering. But God's the one that gives the increase. And then somebody else may get to reap. And sometimes we forget that. And part of it, and let's switch gears just a little bit. Sometimes the imagery of fishing, Jesus talked to them about making them fishers of men. So sometimes that imagery is used as well. When we think about fishing, sometimes we think about the one fellow out there with the fishing pole, throwing the line out, reeling it in. But really, is that the way that they would have understood it? Certainly not. They would have understood some teamwork, not a competition where we're trying to see who can get the biggest fish or who can catch the most fish or whatever. But what they're looking at is not the competition, but the teamwork, the working together. Peter and James and John and Andrew all working together, throwing the net out, bringing it in. We need to think about sometimes these things that we're looking at these things as competition sometimes. Well, which church is the biggest church? And can we get more members than the other church? We need to forget about that competitive type attitude in this arena. We need to remember who we're really competing against is not other churches in the area. We're not competing against one another to see who can convert the most people. We're competing against the devil to see how many we can save from him. That's the real competition. He's the real adversary. He's the one that we have to be fighting against, not one another. And so many times, you know, you see the infighting over, well, who gets to baptize them or who gets to get the credit for this person coming. That's the wrong attitude. Why do we think about it like that? It's not about us competing with each other. It's about us working together to serve the Lord. Paul many times talks about co-workers. And when you're trying to reap in the harvest, you're just wanting to get the harvest in before the weather goes bad. You're not worried about, I picked four rows of cotton and you only picked three rows, so I'm better than you. No, you're just, let's get it all in. If a little kid goes out there and picks a half a row, good for them. They got half a row that I don't have to pick. And that's every step that we make toward that goal is one step closer to heaven for all of us and for all of those that we bring with us. And so we need to think about that in terms of this. The one sows and another reaps. And then he says in verse 38, "I send you to reap that for which you did not labor. Others have labored and you've entered into their labor." Now specifically right there, of course, he's talking about how he's talked with the woman and she's gone back and talked with the others and now they're coming out. And now the disciples are going to have the opportunity to talk to these people as well and be a part of reaping the harvest. And I think about that sometimes. You know, we get discouraged. We look at the day of Pentecost and we say, wow, you know, Peter preached that one sermon and 3,000 people obeyed the gospel. Where is that today? Why can't we do that? Well, what we forget sometimes is he was entering into to labor that had been done by others leading up to that point. All of the prophets had been prophesying about the Messiah to come. Everything had been leading up to it. Jesus had been teaching. John the Immerser had been teaching. And all of that thing had been leading up to it. And of course they had the miraculous of the speaking in tongues going on that day as well, that helped to make all of those things possible. But they were able to reap what somebody else had sowed. And sometimes that happens with us as well. But we need not be discouraged just because we don't have 3,000 people obeying the gospel every week. That was an unusual circumstance. And as you read through many of the rest of the letters to the churches, you certainly don't read about that happening in a lot of other places. That happened there in Jerusalem. And then, of course, it continued to grow in Jerusalem till it was up to about 5,000, and then it continued to grow after that. But in a lot of the other towns, there weren't big, huge churches right off the bat. When Paul went to some of these various places and started the church, he didn't get 3,000 folks. He'd get 2 or 3 or 4 and start with that and build on that. So we need not be discouraged by the fact that we're not seeing something like the day of Pentecost happening every time we turn around. We shouldn't expect that it would. All right, let's skip down now. And of course, the people then come on out and they begin to believe in Jesus. But down in verse 43 then, he stayed there for 2 days and then he went to Galilee. Verse 44 tells us that Jesus himself had testified that a prophet has no honor in his own hometown. And we certainly see that to be the case with Jesus. In Nazareth, they tried to kill him. They were offended by him. And they even tried to kill him. But even in that whole area around Galilee, some of the people did believe. I mean, he didn't mean nobody would believe. But this is a general statement. That he wasn't going to have the kind of response here that he got when he was over there in Samaria. In fact, he didn't even have that kind of response. But when he came to Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him because they had seen all that he'd done in Jerusalem at the feast. And they had gone to the feast and they had seen the miracles that he performed there. And so now he was coming and they kind of thought of him in many times, in many ways, that a lot of the people looked at him as just kind of a freak of nature, so kind of like the circus coming to town. They weren't really looking at him as the Son of God. They weren't looking at him as the one who was to come or the Messiah. They were just we want to see a cool miracle. And you know, today it would be the same way. If Jesus were to come and do miracles like he did then, don't you think there'd be people wanting to go wherever he was going to try to get to see a miracle? Well, sure there would. There would be people clamoring all over each other to try to get to, oh, I want to see a miracle. Wouldn't that be great if we could see a miracle? And there'd be people pestering him constantly to try to get a miracle. And that was what these people, they had seen some miracles, and so they wanted more of the same. But he comes back to Cana. That's where he had turned the water to wine back in chapter 2. Remember, that was, John said, the first of his miracles, the beginning of his signs was there in Cana where he turned the water to wine. Now he comes back there. Now at Capernaum, there was an official, someone who was very well-to-do, someone high up, person of authority and position, who had someone in his family who was ill. His son was sick to the point of death, even. And when he heard about Jesus coming, he made the trip from Capernaum to Cana. Now, the indications are that that's about 16 miles over some kind of rough terrain. This fellow was in pretty dire straits to go 16 miles through some tough, rough terrain on foot, likely, or maybe with a donkey or something like that, to get there because he had heard that Jesus had come. Now, when we hear that, we might think, wow, this fellow's really got some faith. But it's interesting, when he comes and asks Jesus to come down to his house and heal his son, in verse 48, Jesus says, "Unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe." Now, the you here is a plural you. He's not just specifically talking to this man, but he's lumping him in with a group of other people who are unwilling to just believe in Jesus because of his teaching, but they've got to see these signs and wonders. And it's interesting, when he says signs and wonders, sometimes people say, well, what's the difference in a sign and a wonder? It's exactly what we talked about this morning. The difference in a sign and a wonder is how you're looking at it. To the people, they were wonders. These miracles that Jesus performed were just wondrous things. They were something exciting, something phenomenal, something extraordinary. Something they'd never seen before. And so that was just the big excitement to them. That's what made it a wonder. But to John, who's seen it through the eyes of trying to remind people, this is God in the flesh. To him, each one of these miracles that Jesus performed was a sign that he was who he claimed to be, and that he was who John is claiming to be. Remember that John is writing this, he tells us himself over at the end of the book, I've written this to you so that you may believe. These things are recorded so you'll believe. He said, now Jesus did a lot of other things, but I wrote these down so you would believe in him. They were signs. They were, you know, the old saying, well, what do you need God to give you a sign? Yeah, people did. They were obsessed with getting to see a sign of some kind. The problem was, when God would give them the signs, they wouldn't read them. They'd turn a blind eye to the sign. They wouldn't pay attention to the sign. They'd just marvel at the wonder of what had just happened and forget, even to the point that the Pharisees even attributed Jesus' miracles at one point to the power of the devil instead of giving credit to God where it belonged. So that's an amazing thing to think about as we look at these signs and wonders. But the wonder was the something exciting and extraordinary, but the same deed, it viewed in the light of that it showed who Jesus Christ was a sign of his deity. And that's what John records, seven signs specifically and in detail. Now obviously, and here's the thing that will be confusing to us to some degree perhaps if we're not careful. Down in verse 54, the last verse of chapter 4, if you notice there, he says, this was now the second sign that Jesus did when he had come from Judea to Galilee. Well, that doesn't mean it was only the second miracle that Jesus had ever performed. Because remember, the reason this nobleman came was because in Jerusalem, Jesus had performed a lot of miracles. So this wasn't the second miracle that he had performed. It was just the second one that he had done back home, so to speak, here in Cana. It was just the second one that John recorded fully. John didn't record the details of the ones that he did at the feast in Jerusalem. We don't know what all they may have been. And certainly John didn't spend his time talking about all of those details. In verse 49, the official says, Sir, is the way many of the translations will translate it. Some might actually translate it as Lord, and that's what it should be. The Greek word there is actually the word for Lord. But that doesn't mean that he believes in the Lord as the Lord. We forget that the word Lord was just a term of respect that was given back then to many people. It didn't always mean the Lord in the way that we would say it. It was the same as calling someone sir, and that's why many translate it that way, because he doesn't really have full faith here. He says, sir, come down before my child dies. And Jesus says, go and your son will live. Now the man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and went on his way. So he does believe when Jesus says, go and he'll live. He does believe what Jesus said. But then as he's going home, his servants meet him to tell him that his son is recovering. Now realize, he didn't go home until the next day. Because the servants come to him and he asks them, when did he start getting better? And they said, yesterday, about 1 in the afternoon, the fever left him. So this is a day later. It was the day before that Jesus had talked to him. And then the father knew that was the hour that Jesus had told him, your son's going to live. And then at the end of verse 53 there, that says, and he himself believed. Well, wait a minute. It said he believed back there in verse 50. Why is it saying he believed again? He believed and his household. His belief has changed. In verse 50, he believed what Jesus said about his boy getting better. But here in verse 53, the indication is his faith has grown and developed to the point now he believes Jesus is the Messiah. He really believes that this is the one who came to this world from God. And so he's got a different perspective on it. And before we close out, I just want us to look at these seven signs that John records. And you might want to make a note of them. You could, if you want to turn back to John 2 and make the note there, or maybe if you want to do them, make a note from each one. If you look at John 2, that's the beginning of miracles, was the turning of water to wine. But then next to John chapter 2, you could put that this is the first miracle, and then put John 4 next to that. And so that'll lead you to the next one. The next one then is this one in John 4 where he heals this man's son. And then next to that one, you can underline where it says this is the second miraculous sign, verse 54. And then next to that, you could put John chapter 5 where he's going to heal someone. And then there next to John chapter 5, you can put John 6. And there's actually two in John 6. And then over there at the feeding of the 5,000, you could put the one a little further down where he walks on the Sea of Galilee. Also, and then down at that one, you could put John chapter 9, where he's going to heal a man born blind. And then down there in John 9, you can write John 11, where he's going to raise Lazarus from the dead. Now of these, the healing of the official son, the feeding of the 5,000, and the walking on the water are recorded in the synoptic gospels. Dwayne talked about that a little bit this morning, how Matthew, Mark, and Luke are so much alike. They've got a lot of the same material. These are three that actually were recorded by the other gospel writers. But all of the others, the other four, are unique to John. He's the only one that tells those stories. He's the only one that tells about those miracles. And he gives all the details of them. Now some would say, you could write down there's an eighth one. And perhaps the greatest sign, the sign that Jesus said he was going to give, no sign will be given them except this. Just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the whale, so the Son of Man will be 3 days and three nights in the belly of the earth. His own resurrection was the final sign that John records, that he didn't stay in the grave. And certainly that would be the greatest of all. But each of these signs has a purpose. Miracles in the Bible always have a purpose. They're never just there because they're a fun story or they're neat or something. See, that's the worldly way of looking at it. That's what the problem was these people were looking at the miracles as, oh, look, here's something really exciting and fun and supernatural happening, instead of looking at it as something that was teaching them some lesson. Each of these reveals a different aspect of Jesus' nature, and of his character, and of his ability as God. And first of all, of course, the changing of water to wine shows his power over nature. He could take water and turn it into wine. That's a power over nature that he had. This second one that we're looking at, particularly with this healing, notice he doesn't go. His presence was not even required. And this shows his power over distance, over space. He's not limited by where he is. Well, I can heal somebody if I can touch them. No, he could heal somebody 16 miles away just by saying the word. And that was something, that doesn't work. You know these faith healers that we have today? Oh yeah, if you come and if you give me some money, I'll heal you. But try having them heal somebody that's in the hospital somewhere in another town. Try having them heal them. No, they can't do that. They won't even try. Because they know it can't work the way that they do. Because they're just fakes, to be honest with you. But Jesus could. He could do it over distances. And that one also shows his power over illness. Disease, in essence. Then the healing of the cripple in John 5 that we'll look at next week is going to show some of his power over not just disease, but over other infirmities like being crippled. And it's also going to show some other things about him as well that we'll look at that time. The feeding of the 5,000 shows the extent in terms of quantity. So he didn't just perform a miracle for one person, but enough for 5,000. So it shows he's not limited by numbers. He's not limited by how much he can do. And then walking on the water, of course, has to do, again, somewhat with his power over nature, his power over the laws of physics, because physically, I don't know, this winter sometime I may show y'all how I can walk on water. It's really not real hard when it's frozen to walk on water, if you're careful. You can slip, though, if you're not careful. But just to walk on water, we know we can't do that. It's one thing to get water skis on and ski on the water. That's one thing. But to walk on, it's a totally different thing. And so it showed his control over the laws of physics that were in play there. And then he healing a man that was born blind showed the extent to which he could heal somebody. It didn't matter how long, it didn't matter, and this one with the cripple as well, the time factor. The guy had that disease for 38 years that had crippled him, had that problem. And then, of course, raising Lazarus from the dead, that one's pretty obvious. He has even power over death. And that's, you can heal somebody that's sick, but what about somebody that's dead? That's a step even beyond that. And so as we look at these seven signs, their purpose is to show us that there is nothing our Lord cannot do. He's capable of doing anything in any place for any number of people. And he's not limited by any of those things that limit us as human beings. Time and space and the laws of nature and the laws of physics and death and all of these things that limit us and control us and affect us. They don't affect him. You know, the purpose of miracles throughout the scriptures is always, you know, obviously there are a lot of different details there, but always there is the purpose of wanting to bring glory and honor to God, to bring to people to faith in Jesus Christ, to believe in God. Of course, the apostles were able to do miracles to confirm that the word that they spoke was from God. And there are many other situations in the New Testament where people did these miracles. It was always to try to get people to bring themselves to faith in God, or to strengthen that faith in God, or in some way to build on that faith and confirm that faith. As with this man, had a little bit of faith. He believed a little bit that Jesus could do some miraculous things. He'd heard about, or possibly even seen, what had happened in Jerusalem, and he thought, maybe, just maybe, this guy could do something for me. But Jesus used that as an opportunity to confirm that faith and help him take the next step in faith. Beyond just, well, he can do a little something, to he really is the Son of God. Now, this man didn't make that kind of confession, but he comes to believe, and his whole household believes, based on what Jesus was able to do. And we also notice there, Jesus said the word, and at that same hour, that fever had left the boy. He didn't have to wait till a week later or several hours later. As it was an immediate effect. And that was one of the keys, that Jesus always did things immediately. And you know, he does the same thing with sin. When someone comes to Jesus Christ in humble obedience to him, repenting of their sins and confessing him as the Christ, and being willing to be baptized in water based on their belief in him, he immediately washes those sins away. It doesn't have to take weeks or months. It's an immediate effect. The sin is gone. And the same is true for us as Christians. If we've wandered away, if we've fallen into sin, whatever situation we might be in where we need to be forgiven, if we'll come to him and repent of those sins and confess those sins to him, immediately he forgives them. It doesn't take him hours or weeks or months. There's no need for us to go on some other process. When we ask him with a penitent heart to forgive us of those things, he does it. if you're here tonight and you need to respond, either in initial obedience to Him and obeying the gospel, or if as a Christian you need to get back right with Him because of something in your life, what are you waiting for? He can do it right now if you will. If you're here and need to respond, please do so as we stand and sing.